Welcome, everyone. This is the fourth and final lecture in the short sovereign debt crisis class, and it's good that it's winding up because it's possible the euro and the sovereign debt crisis will be resolved pretty soon. So it's good that we're wrapping the course up, and so our last discussion on prospects for the future will actually still be the future at that point. So what we're going to talk about tonight is just break it up into three sections, focus on prospects for the Eurozone, then talk a little bit about prospects for the U.S., because I had a few people asking me about that, and then just to give my bird's eye view of this crisis and the context of what's been going on the last decade, and we'll see where things might be headed from a global perspective. All right, so let's focus on the Eurozone. So the big thing is Germany going to backstop the pigs? And notice that's not a typo on my part. I didn't include Iceland in this particular, when I'm using pigs here on this particular slide. That I think Iceland at this point, for whatever reason, people aren't worried about that. Partially just because now we're worried about the countries that are using the euro. And somebody, I apologize, I forget which student it was, but somebody in this class really made a great point a week or two ago that I've incorporated. I mean, I had been thinking along the same lines, but the student really crystallized it for me, and now I've just picked it up in stride. I actually used it when Tom Woods was interviewing me yesterday when he was the guest host for Peter Schiff. And the question or the analogy goes like this, saying, In the grand scheme of things, why is this even an issue? Like, why are we so seamlessly moving from, okay, some governments in the Eurozone area are running into trouble with their solvency issues in terms of their sovereign debt, so why are people talking about the euro possibly collapsing? Like, what's the connection? And the analogy the student used was to say, if the state government of California defaulted on its bonds, it's not like investors around the world would say, oh my gosh, that's it, I'm dumping the dollar. That means now the dollar project is going to fail, and it was good while it lasted. It wouldn't even occur to anybody to think that the solvency of the California state government would have anything to do with the solvency of the dollar itself. So there's at least two things here. One is, actually, you need to push the analogy further, that the reason nobody would connect the two is that there's technically nothing connecting them. But suppose that the Federal Reserve, to stave off the California bankruptcy, had been buying up large quantities of California state debt, and suppose that when it finally did declare bankruptcy, at that point the Fed owned more than 50% of all the outstanding bonds issued by the California state government, then you can see actually there would be a link between the two. And so it's not obvious. I mean, I'm not saying that the dollar would collapse in that scenario, but I'm just saying right now the reason it strikes us as absurd is that the Fed doesn't have intrinsically anything to do with the California state government, whereas right now, as we'll see when we start going through these slides tonight, the ECB, the European Central Bank, does have a lot to do with the sovereign debt that's in trouble. Okay, so that's part of what's going on, is that, and like I said, I'll flesh this out in a little bit in a few slides from now, but the ECB is already on the hook for a lot of this debt. So that's partially why the currency of the euro is being sucked into these discussions of what prima facie should just be bonds issued by various countries' governments. The other thing is that it's not just a coincidence that these two things got linked. All right, this was the whole problem, or the challenge, if you will, of the euro project from the get-go. That the idea was, and I don't know if we stressed this in week two of this class, but if not, well, let me just emphasize it now. Remember, the idea was, the people who were for it, they were thinking that by joining together, they would become a stronger economic bloc. They wanted to be like the United States in several of those respects. And so they, you know, they thought, okay, if we're all using one currency, we lower transaction costs, it makes it easier for businesses to, you know, conduct operations in one jurisdiction versus the other, because they don't have to keep a bunch of different, you know, just the accounting is a lot easier, that sort of thing. It's easier for workers to know what they're getting paid if it's all in the same currency, so on and so forth, right? So there's lots of good economic reasons in terms of minimizing transaction costs and making future planning easier. But the problem was the various governments had different attitudes towards fiscal responsibility or discipline. And so in particular, the German government, for obvious reasons, is very hawkish, and so they're conservative, and so they don't like to run massive budget deficits, and they certainly don't want the central bank to engage in easy money, whereas other European governments were far more liberal in that respect. And so that was the problem, and that's why, I remember, they had all of those stringent rules for what your government needed to do before being allowed to join the countries that were using the euro, and to be an official member along with all those, and to be able to have your representatives be involved in the decision-making process for the eurozone monetary policy. Okay, so that's why it's not just some odd coincidence that we're linking the fiscal behavior of the various constituent governments with the euro itself. That was from day one, was a major challenge. And so the fact that now these problems are manifesting themselves is showing that, okay, all those rules and safeguards that we thought were put in place before we launched this project obviously failed. And there's various reasons for why that happened. With the case of Greece, one of the things was they were just flat out lying. They were doing all kinds of accounting tricks and doing things. I can't give you any specifics off the top of my head, but they were using derivatives to hide how much, how big budget deficits their government was actually running. All right, so that's partly what happened, and that's partly what set off this crisis initially, was that when a new government came to power, they were a little bit more transparent because they could get away with it politically. You know, they could just say, whoa, we just kind of came into office and looked at the books, and holy cow, those clowns in here before were running bigger deficits than anybody realized, because they knew eventually it was going to, people were going to find out, and so they wanted to, you know, partially spring the bad news on everybody while they could, you know, arguably claim this wasn't our fault, we're just taking over now, and it was those crooks that were in here before. All right, so that was partly what set this thing in motion a few years ago. So the point is, the people who were against joining this Euro project from day one can now say, see, we told you this was going to happen. So that's partly why this crisis is threatening, not just, so in other words, that's why this isn't just a matter of, oh, gee, the person who's holding on some Greek bonds right now is sweating bullets, but people are wondering, is this going to make the whole Eurozone collapse, and are people going to pull out? So in some of those news stories I've been giving you, and of course if you just are following this stuff, I mean, the news is literally breaking hourly at times with this stuff. I mean, there, more and more people are starting to say, forget this, that, you know, the German people in particular are thinking, okay, we've already pumped in hundreds of billions that we're on the hook for, and if Greece and these other countries just totally default, we're going to be out hundreds of billions. And so how long are we going to keep this up? Who's to say if we bail them out again that we won't just have the crisis return in another 12 months, and then they're going to want more and more and more. And so why don't we just walk away now and take the pain now, but at least we'll be masters of our own destiny going forward. That, you know, come to think of it, we never really trusted these other countries anyway. Let's just go back to having the German people determine their own monetary and fiscal policies and let the rest of Europe do whatever the heck they want to do. All right, so that's the attitude here, that some of the stronger countries are regretting or at least factions within their governments and the general public, of course, are regretting having joined. And so now that this problem is so severe, they're starting to say, you know what, why don't we just punt this thing? Okay. So what I'm going over in this particular slide here, and this news is dated. Like I said, the stuff is changing here dramatically. As of today, for example, there was a relative wave of optimism, at least the last I checked, you know, early on in the trading session, where Merkel came out and some other people in France were coming out and trying to calm the public and say, whoa, you know, these are rumors floating around that we're going to abandon the euro and that we're going to kick Greece out. We're not doing any of that. So, you know, part of it could just be there's a power struggle going on within these individual governments, and some people are thinking, ah, here's our opportunity to get out of the euro, and other people are trying to say, whoa, we got to nail this thing down and get through this crisis, you know, because we worked so hard to put the euro in place. So I think that's partly what's going on here, and you can see the factions vying for power and trying to set the public narrative. But in any event, as of the morning of September 13th, two-year Greek yields were up to almost 75%. I rounded there, which is just, you know, astronomical. 10-year yields were 25%. To give you an idea of the contrast, German 10-year yields were only 1.7%, which was actually lower than U.S. Treasuries for a 10-year. So that's really just showing you this disparity and how people are fleeing from Greek government-issued debt, and they're going into the relative safe havens of German government bonds and U.S. Treasuries. If you look, again, as of the morning of September 13th, the credit default swap rates, you know, so how much you had to pay to a third party that would indemnify you in case the Greek government defaulted on its bonds, the numbers implied that the market thought there was a 98% chance that the Greek government would default on its bonds. And so that's a pretty big risk. Let me just clarify, when we talk about default, for example, you might look at that and say, what the heck? Why is there anyone even buying it? If there's a 98% chance that it's going to default and you're not going to get your money back, because when we say default here, that's a broad term. And these credit default swaps kick in whenever there's something called a credit event. So it doesn't mean that if you lent 1,000 euros to the Greek government and then it defaults, it doesn't mean you're going to get zero back. It just means you might not get all of it back, or you're not going to get it back in a timely fashion. Right, so when people have been talking about the possibility of just letting Greece default on its bonds and go through a debt restructuring, the numbers they're throwing around, they'll throw around things in the ballpark of what they call a 50% haircut. So what that means is they might go through and just say, okay, we know there's no way the Greek government can possibly honor all these obligations. They're not going to take in enough in tax revenue over the next 10 years to be able to make all of these cash payments that they owe to Greek government bondholders over the next 10 years. It's just impossible. It's not going to happen. So what do we do? Well, let's try to be fair about it. We'll just go through systematically, and you know, there's like maybe preferred bondholders and things that perhaps, you know, I don't know exactly the composition of the bonds issued by the Greek government, but maybe there's, you know, different privileges, and maybe some bonds are considered to be more sacrosanct than others. But in terms of the generic stuff that most of the outsiders are holding, we would just go through and just do a 50% principal reduction. All right, so just for all the amount that you thought you were going to get, we're just going to cut that number in half and then continue to pay you as if we only owed you half as much as what we really do. All right, and so that would just, boom, instantly reduce the Greek government's debt by 50%. So then it could, you know, then stick to that new schedule and at least pay those people off 50 cents on the euro, or 50 cents on the dollar. I don't know what you would say for the euro. Okay, so that's and again, don't quote me on that figure, but I mean, that's the general idea here. So it's, when you talk, when we say a 98% chance of Greek default, it doesn't mean somebody who had money to the Greek government by buying its bonds. It doesn't mean that person's going to see zero. It just means the person's almost certainly not going to get paid off exactly according to schedule on time, the full amount. Okay, so what is the big deal? So what if Greece defaults? A lot of people have been asking that. You know, what's, why is this such an issue? Well, partly what's happened, and I just alluded to this a few minutes ago, is the various international mega financial organizations already bailed them out. I mean, that's what made the crisis, that's what allegedly, you know, solved the problem a year ago. And now it's just come back because people realize we didn't really fix the underlying problem. Okay, so I couldn't, the most recent data I could get for this kind of information that I was trying to get for you guys was relevant or was up to date as of June 2011. So as of that time, the European Central Bank, the IMF, various Eurozone governments and other Eurozone central banks, so if a particular country uses the euro but isn't part of the jurisdiction of the European Central Bank, that's, you know, so the, but it has its own central bank, so that's included in this figure. If you looked at those institutions, as of June 2011, they held more than 50% of all outstanding Greek government debt. Okay, so this is, so you can see what had happened is, as the Greek government's solvency came more and more into question, people in the private sector said, forget this, I don't want to hold that stuff. And so when these public, you know what I mean by the word public, government or government-sponsored organizations stepped up to the plate to allegedly rescue the Greek government, what did that mean in practice? It meant they had to go out and soak up all this Greek government debt. And so by doing that, they suppressed the yields. Because remember, and this is obvious for most of you, but let's just make sure you guys aren't missing the big picture here. If you're heavily in debt, the interest rate that's being charged on your debt can be crucial in determining whether you can get up, dig yourself out, or whether you have to declare bankruptcy. All right, so if because if you owe a bunch of money, but it's rolling over at a low interest rate, then as long as you just cut your spending and do what you can to raise your income, you can, you know, make your interest payments and then try to pay off some of that debt over time and slowly pull yourself out, just like a private household can. But the problem is, as that various components of that debt mature and people want their principal back, you have to roll it over. So in any given year, how can I put it? Like right now, for example, the U.S. federal government, and I'm switching to the U.S. because I know their numbers better. The U.S. federal government owes people roughly $14.5 trillion. Right? That's the official public debt, give or take, of the U.S. And if you looked at what the interest payment is, it's a few hundred billion. All right, because the interest rate on U.S. debt's pretty low. But in terms of how much total new debt does the Treasury have to auction off every year, it's a lot higher than that number of the explicit interest cost. All right, so because, for example, if there's a 30-year bond, Treasury bond that somebody's holding that happens to mature this year, they need to get their whole principal back. And so the government, you know, the federal government has to pay them that money. And so how do they make up for that? Well, they just auction off a new 30-year bond and get a bunch of money up front to, you know, in order to roll it over. And so what's happening is the interest is just the fact that when a bond matures, you know, you're paying, you're either making the explicit interest payments all along, or if it's a short-term thing, it matures and you have to pay off more than what you can get up front from auctioning off a new short-term bill. All right, so my point is just in terms of the rollover, in terms of how much money's coming in and going out, it's a much bigger number than the explicit interest charge or finance charge listed. So it'd be like, let me just, I'm belaboring this for those of you who are, who know this stuff inside and out, but I just want to make sure people get this. So think of it in terms of a household, and you owe a bunch of money to credit cards. If you have to pay off a particular balance, and you do it with a balance transfer from another credit card, you see what I'm saying? That's one way you can do it. And so every month, you know, you're just thinking, really, on net, I'm just paying the finance charges and my overall principal, my overall debt, how much do I owe to the credit card companies, stays the same, let's say. But if in any particular month, all of a sudden, they cut you off and you stop getting those balance transfer offers in the mail, well, then you're dead, because then a particular company might say, okay, we want you to pay us off right now, and then you can't do it, right? So that's what was going on with Greece is, they were the amount of money they owed in general was huge compared to their tax revenues, but as long as the interest rate stayed low, in theory they could have climbed out. They could have just cut their spending, you know, raised in their mind, raised taxes, and that would have been a good idea, and then just started whittling that thing away, and in a few years they would have been okay. But the problem was, once international investors got nervous, they were going to stop rolling it over, and when it matured. So if they had lent 1,000 euros to the Greek government and were getting paid 2% per year, and then when that particular thing came due, they were just going to want their principal back, and they weren't going to roll it over. So that was the issue. So to prevent that from happening, that's why the ECB, the IMF, and all these other governments had to step in, and they had to sop up all of the outstanding Greek government bonds to keep the yields from going up, because if the yields went up too high, then the Greek government was finished. They had to knock down the interest rate so that there was even a chance that the Greek government could pull out of this without defaulting. Okay, so the point is, how much did these government institutions have to absorb in order to knock down the yields on Greek government debt back to levels where it was possible the Greeks could possibly climb out of this? Well, more than 50%. Which was, in the total amount, was 360 billion euros. All right, so that meant 180 billion was on the books of these institutions. So that right there gives you an idea of how big of an issue this is and why all these government agencies are so concerned, because if for no other reason, besides all the, you know, the prestige and psychological problems and all that stuff and the domino effect, just on the face of it, they're holding 180 billion or so euros worth of Greek government debt, so it's a big deal if Greece defaults. Now, just focus on the European Central Bank itself. They held, again, this was in early June 2011, about 444 billion euros in total debt from all the PIGS area countries, 190 billion of which was tied to Greece. Now let me clarify something here, and when you're reading news articles on this and so forth, you just have to be careful about what these numbers are referring to, because you might say, wait a minute, hang on, how can it be that the ECB by itself has 190 billion euros worth of Greek debt, when up here you just said total Greek debt is 360 billion euros, and all these things just put together only have about 50%. You see the problem that right there, 50% of that is 180 billion, and yet I'm saying here the ECB alone holds 190 billion. Well, the answer is because these are comparing different things. This statistic up here is referring to debt just issued by the Greek government itself, whereas this figure of 190 billion includes asset-backed securities, which I believe must be issued by private entities, but it's still tied to Greece itself. Okay, so that's, unless one of these figures is just wrong, because I got these from two different sources. So I think that's what's explaining the discrepancy in the numbers. So anyway, just like I say, be careful when you're reading various figures, that sometimes they'll talk about Greek debt and it's not clear if they mean debt just pertaining to the country of Greece in any capacity, or they mean literally debt issued by the Greek government itself. But either way, you can see these are massive numbers. And then you say, okay, well, 190 billion euros of the European Central Bank's assets are just tied to either the Greek government or assets tied to the country of Greece. So if they plunge in value, you know, how big a deal is that? Suppose they lose 90 billion of that. Is that the end of the world? Because, you know, so it's a freaking European Central Bank. I mean, they're pretty rich, right? Well, the European Central Bank's capital is only 82 billion euros. Right? So the point is, if they were to lose 90 billion, let's say, off of their Greek assets, they would be wiped out. The European Central Bank itself would become insolvent. So what does that mean? What would it mean if the European Central Bank itself went bankrupt, where its assets were less than its liabilities? I'm just going to talk about it for a few moments tonight. If you want to read more about this stuff, I linked you here to an article that I wrote for the Mises Daily earlier this year, talking about the Federal Reserve, what would happen if the Fed became insolvent. And I'm not going to go over it tonight. Why that came up is in January of this year, the Federal Reserve implemented an obscure rule change in its accounting and how it dealt with certain scenarios. And I suspected at the time, and as a few other people did, that really what the Fed was doing was getting ready in case it had to take huge write-downs on its own assets, that just in terms of the accounting, it wouldn't reduce its capital. And so you can, like I said, I'm not going to talk about it tonight, but you can go read that article if you're curious, that I think the Fed's accountants basically were putting in place something so that if and when their assets plunged in value, they could justifiably say, oh, no, we're not insolvent because of this rule change we made, and they wouldn't do it on the spot, and it would look like, they could just look like, no, this is something we've been doing for a while. What are we talking about? Okay, let me just walk you through this a little bit. So this is a simplified ECB balance sheet. I just want to be clear, I pick these numbers to try to be close to reality, but I'm making these up. All right, so this is more just a hypothetical example with plausible numbers that are in the ballpark, but don't by any means think that this is actually the ECB's balance sheet, okay? So how does the balance sheet work? You've got assets on the left side, and on the right side you've got liabilities plus what's called capital, or what's the same thing, equity, owner's equity, shareholder's equity. All right, so those terms are all interchangeable for our purposes here when you talk about capital or equity or shareholder's equity or owner's equity. All right, so the idea is a financial entity, whether it's a private corporation or, in this case, the European Central Bank, it's got assets, you know, things that it owns that have a market value, and then also has liabilities, people to whom it owes money. So on the asset side, we've got things like 190 billion euros worth of Greek assets, 254 billion of other pigs-related assets. I Googled this. I can't vouch for the accuracy of it, but apparently the ECB has 13 billion euros worth of gold holdings and other assets that are directly tied to gold. And because their total balance sheet is roughly 1.9 trillion euros, I just backed out this number. And so then there must be 43 billion in other assets. Okay, so you list all these different assets, you add them all up, total assets of about 1.9 trillion euros. On the liability side, well, we know that their equity from that last slide was 82 billion euros, so then I just back this number out. And so, okay, that means their total liabilities, therefore, must be roughly 1.8 trillion euros of liabilities. So this, now you say, well, okay, what does it mean if a central bank has a liability? What does that typically mean? Well, the lion's share of it is the money in that region. All right, so the actual currency floating around Europe, you know, the euro itself, the paper currency, that's a liability of the European Central Bank. And commercial banks that have accounts with the ECB denominated in euros, you know, that would be part of the monetary base, if you know that term, that's also, in terms of the bookkeeping, a liability of the ECB. All right, so the point is, right now, or as of June, their assets of 1.9 trillion were higher than their liabilities of 1.81 trillion, and the difference of 82 billion euros was the capital of the ECB. So if you know, if you're familiar with leverage, you can see that this is an incredibly leveraged position, that their liabilities are something, you know, like 20 times or more, like 23 times their equity. So that's what leverage is saying. It's saying, you know, what's your total liabilities relative to your capital. So what that means is, if their assets fall just even a little bit in terms of percentages, they get wiped out. So, but what does that mean, to get wiped out? Well, again, if you're a private corporation, what does it mean to be solvent? It means your assets are higher than your liabilities. The market value of your assets is higher than your liabilities. Solvency is different from liquidity. Liquidity means not only are you solvent, but you can make your payments on time. Whereas, in principle, you could be solvent but illiquid. So if you had a bunch of assets that were the market valued as being worth more than your liabilities, you're solvent, but let's say you owed a few people, you know, they you had borrowed money from them, let's say, and it was due, and so you owed them cash payments, but your assets were all tied up in long-term investments, so you didn't have the cash flow, you could be illiquid even if the market value of your assets was higher than your liabilities. So you might have to, you know, sell some assets or go try to borrow money from somebody else to pay off the first people. Okay, but what does it mean to be insolvent? If you're a private corporation, it means you owe people more, you owe your creditors more than you have in assets, meaning that your owner's equity is negative. Because the equation is that assets equals liabilities plus capital. So you see here, 1.9 trillion equals 1.9 trillion over here, just adding these two numbers up. That's 1.9 trillion, and that has to equal this. So what happens is, if your assets go down in value, then the way you keep these two things balanced is your owner's equity technically would become negative, and that's what it means to say you're insolvent. Because that means you owe people more. This entity owes more than it has in assets. All right. So if you're a private organization, corporation, if that happens, that's it. You're bankrupt. You have to shut down. I mean, I guess you could go into bankruptcy protection and resolve it that way. But the point is, they have to. You can't just keep chugging along. That's illegal. I mean, you're bankrupt. You're insolvent. You got to do something about that. So the question, well, what happens if a central bank finds itself insolvent? So I already talked about the Federal Reserve, I believe, has taken steps to avoid this or prevent this from happening, that they changed the way they do their accounting such that if they did, like let's say interest rates go up, and so that the treasuries that the Federal Reserve holds, their market value goes down. If that were to happen to the Fed in such a manner that the Fed gets wiped out, and it's, you know, if you did the accounting normally, its equity would be negative, they've changed the accounting rules such that they wouldn't actually mark this down. Instead, they would give themselves a negative liability, which, if you think about it, that doesn't even make any sense. What the heck is a negative liability? But that's the way they would do the accounting, so that they would still get this number to be equal to that number, but the way they would do it is not to bump this down. They would put in a negative number up here. And so to say, yep, we owe this much to these people, we owe this much to these people, they would say the U.S. Treasury we owe a negative amount to, that they would then work off over time. Okay, so anyway, that's, like I say, if you're curious more to read more about that, that's the article I linked to before. So I think that's the way the Fed is going to handle it. Now, I don't know what the ECB, if they've done similar, if they've engaged in similar preparations in terms of the accounting to involve, because so people ask, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Why would, what would physically stop them? Nothing would, because they're a central bank with legal tender power and they're with no link to gold. That's a fiat currency. So it's true, there'd be nothing, whether the ECB has $82 billion in equity or 82 billion euros in equity or negative 200 billion euros in equity, in the grand scheme, that doesn't really matter. And here's why, because these liabilities aren't really liabilities in the conventional sense. Right, so a commercial bank, if it had assets over here and liabilities over here, it's a commercial bank's liabilities would be things like the checking account balances of its customers. So if Joe Smith has 1,000 euros on deposit with his bank in Vienna, then that's a liability of that Viennese bank, because he can walk in and say, I want to close my account, give me 1,000 euros in paper currency, and then he walks out the door, and they legally owe that to him. So they better be able to pay that. Okay, but the European Central Bank, if one of the member banks, of the, you know, the bank in Vienna or wherever, says to the ECB, hey, we have 500 million euros electronically on deposit with you, and the ECB checks its books and says, yep, we got it right here in our liabilities. Yep, that's right. And they say, and the commercial bank says, give me that amount in euros, like the currency. They can just have it printed up. Right? I'm not as familiar with the mechanics of how it works in with the ECB. You know, with the Fed, it would just be the Bureau of Engraving and Printing would fire up the actual printing press and just print up dollars and give it to the people. All right, so it's a little bit weird. To be classifying these things as liabilities, because back when all the countries were on a gold standard, then it really was a liability. Because if somebody walked in and said, hey, here's $1,000 in U.S. currency, I want a certain weight of gold, you had to be able to produce it. But now, you know, the euro's not backed by anything legally. It's not if you have euros, even though legally it's a claim on the European Central Bank, or even though the U.S. dollar is a claim on the Federal Reserve and is a liability in an accounting sense, if you give Bernanke or Tim Geithner a $100 bill and say, what do I get for this? And say, we'll give you $10 bills, or we'll give you $5 $20 bills, right? So they're not, it's not like they're out money. So that's, so in the grand scheme, there's nothing in the mechanics of it that would make the ECB have to shut down if it got wiped out. But I, as I talk about in that other article, I think it would be very awkward for the government officials and all these finance ministers and everybody if the European Central Bank took such a huge hit on its holdings of, because it's not just Greek debt, that's the thing. If Greece went down, then presumably the other countries would be vulnerable too. I mean, it would depend on the scenario. If if Germany said, for example, we're not going to, you know, throw Greece to the wolves, but then we'll really backstop Spain and Italy, then maybe that would be different. Maybe that's the way they would deal with it. They would just realize we can't save Greece, but we can save everybody else. So if they did that, okay. But the point is, depending on the scenario, if all these other assets started going too, you know, these ones and these ones, then, you know, they could have a huge hole. And so, again, it would just be very awkward if the ECB technically had negative capital for the next 5 years. I mean, like I say, I don't think they would shut it down. I think they would just say, well, thank goodness it's a central bank and we're not on a gold standard anymore, and they would just keep, you know, start whistling and moving on. But I think the public would really have a slap in the face and realize there is something really fishy going on with the way central banking works. And so I think they would prefer that not to happen. Okay, incidentally, I am seeing some people in the comments mention that these figures here about the European Central Bank, those are consolidated figures. All right, so in this class, we haven't been too careful about, you know, talking about what do we mean when we say the ECB, and there's branch is the right word, in each of the various countries. So that's an amalgamated figure. So depending on, you know, if you're looking at other figures, you might see much smaller amounts attributed to the ECB proper and its balance sheet. All right, so just be aware that there's, because it's a bank, a central bank that spans several countries, that's why you get this issue. Whereas in the United States, there isn't that discrepancy. I mean, it's just there's member banks. You know, there's a Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis and one in Chicago and so forth, but nobody ever worries about, well, wait a minute, how many mortgage-backed securities are held by the one in this particular region or that? I mean, everyone just lumps it all together and say, how much does the Fed hold? Okay, let me spend a little bit of time. Hang on, did I skip a slide? No, okay, we're all right. Let me spend a little bit of time on this. I dug up these figures because what's happening now in the blogosphere and so forth is, and I gave you a taste of this with some of the articles, but if you're diving into this stuff, you're going to see it a lot. The Keynesians, and more broadly the people who are for big government intervention, they have been saying, aha, see, we tried austerity and it didn't work. That all of these orthodox finance ministers and people who were worried about fiscal responsibility and that these countries had to tighten their belts, they got their way. They all implemented strict austerity budgets. They raised taxes. They cut spending. They were heartless to their unemployed and their, you know, orphans and widows and so forth. Their elderly, threw them to the wolves to satisfy these bond investors, and look, it blew up in their face. You still have interest rates rising, and clearly austerity doesn't work. These economies are all sluggish because their governments slash their budgets. So what we need, like we Keynesians have been saying all along, is massive increases in spending to get out of this recession. And then once the recovery is underway, sure, at that point, go ahead and get long-term fiscal discipline in place, but don't be quibbling over a few hundred billion euros here and there right now when the whole fate of Europe hangs in the balance. Okay, that's the narrative they're pushing. So I was curious to say, well, is that really true? You know, when they say these countries have engaged in massive fiscal austerity, what are they talking about? So for one thing, to the extent that these governments have been raising various taxes, well, that's stupid. Even Austrians would say if you're in a really bad recession with high unemployment, you don't raise tax rates on people. That's just going to plunge you deeper into recession, or at the very least is going to make the recovery more sluggish and take longer than it otherwise would. So to the extent that austerity includes tax rate increases, and notice I keep saying tax rate increases because there's a difference. Just I'm going to go off on a small little tangent here. I would encourage you when you're discussing these things or writing and blogging about it, whatever you're doing, don't just use the term tax increase or tax cut, because that's ambiguous. It's not clear if you mean changes in the total receipts taken in by the government or if you mean changes in the rate that is applied to the tax base. And it's not just a semantic, you know, ain't a little distinction. They can move in opposite directions. So, for example, the Hoover administration in 1932 implemented a huge increase in tax rates across the board, and they implemented all sorts of new taxes that hadn't existed, but total revenue only went up a tiny little bit. And then there's also cases where, like on capital gains taxes, for example, in U.S. history, where or things like the luxury tax, where they increased the rate and yet the total revenue taken in actually went down because the activity in that area dropped so much that even though it was being taxed at a higher rate, the total amount of revenue going to the government actually went down. Right? So this is obviously the Laffer curve, if you're familiar with that. So my point is just, when people talk about austerity and so forth, and they say, oh, well, they raise taxes, just you should be clear or careful about what do you mean? Did they raise tax rates, or did they actually take in more revenue? Because, again, to the extent that raising tax rates hurts the economy, it's either partially offset or, in extreme cases, is completely self-defeating. Okay, so that's part of it that I was curious, well, how much of this austerity that they're blaming on or that they're saying didn't work, is that really a criticism of the Austrian libertarian viewpoint? Because no Austrian libertarian would have told these governments to raise tax rates either. So I wanted to just focus on expenditures, but and the problem, though, so there's a couple things. Most of the news reporting on this stuff talks about government budget deficits as a share of their economy. And so they'll say things like, oh, the finance ministers pledged to reduce their deficit such and such percentage points by 2013. And da-da-da. And these are the, you know, the great austerity packages that are being hailed by the finance ministers, and then the ones that Paul Krugman and the other Keynesians are making fun of, saying, yep, that's not going to work, and look at how bad it's been so far. So that's problematic for several reasons, because there again, you can't tell when they make these pledges how much were they, when they were saying we're going to reduce our budget deficit, was it because they thought by raising tax rates, you know, on the VAT or on income or whatever, that they thought that they were going to bring in a lot more revenue when really that revenue isn't going to show up as much because they're killing their economy and they didn't realize it. So there's that aspect. And then the other thing is, if the economy itself is growing or shrinking, well, then obviously that can change the percentages. All right. So in terms of, what I wanted to do was just look at the actual euro expenditures in absolute terms. And then what I wanted to do also, because the other thing is, all these governments, when the crisis kicked in, they all increased their spending a lot, right? Because the Keynesians had their way in the beginning. Governments across the world ramped up their stimulus programs and just their normal safety net spending rose too as the recession got worse. So I was curious to see, when you guys say that you engage in austerity, what do you mean? Just that you partially undid the massive Keynesian increase in your spending, or are you actually spending less than you were before the crisis kicked in? So with that goal in mind, it took me a while to find the right data set, but I've given you the link down here if you want to go play with these numbers some more. So what I did for Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain was I compared what were their budgets, their total government expenditures in 2008, and then what were they 2010. So they, obviously 2011 is not over, so that's, we don't have that. If you want, they do have some quarterly data, but I wanted to just compare apples to apples and and look at this. So you can see Portugal was a lot higher. Ireland was way higher. Greece, admittedly, was a little bit lower, and Spain was higher. Okay, so of all these major regions that are in trouble right now, Greece is the only one whose expenditures by the government in 2010 were actually lower than they were in 2008. And so, you know, just keep this data in mind when you hear reports that they engaged in massive fiscal austerity that, except in the case of Greece, that has largely meant they partially undid the big increase in spending that the Keynesians said would fix things. So it's rather amusing that the Keynesians are blaming austerity on this when really all it was is the Keynesians got the remedy they suggested, and in fairness, Paul Krugman says it should have been more. Okay, but you know, certainly it wasn't like the Heritage Foundation designed the Obama stimulus package. You know, that was a Keynesian thing pushed by Keynesians with a Keynesian analysis justifying it. That didn't work, and then people wanted to start pulling back in the European countries, and so they actually did in many places reduce their spending, but not to the levels of when the crisis first started, except, like they say, for Greece. So it's a little bit odd to say, oh, this clearly shows that Keynesian stimulus is what we need. Somebody asks in the questions, these figures here, is that just the basic operating budgets, or does that include debt service? I believe, I'm not 100% sure, because I'm used to dealing with U.S. data, and so this is European data. The data sets I was looking at said total government expenditures. So I'm assuming these numbers include interest payments on the debt, and that would, you know, that would partially explain why Ireland's expenditures are so much higher. But I'm not sure. I mean, in other words, I can't guarantee you that's what these refer to, but I'm pretty sure this means everything that these governments spent in those respective years. Okay, so what about prospects for the U.S.? Okay, I don't know how well you can see this particular slide, but what it's showing is the fact that the creditors in the United States are actually exposed to, in this particular slide, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. If you want to see more on this stuff, go to this blog post right there. What it is this guy went through and parsed a BIS report that came out a few months ago. So that's where these charts can, he, you know, reproduce some of the salient charts. So if you want to dig into more of this stuff, that's where you want to go. So as you can see here, in this bottom section, the U.S. creditors, their direct exposure is actually fairly low. Like, it's only 5% of the world's exposure. So in other words, if you look at who owns directly the Greek government debt, then then 95% of it is held by institutions that are not in the United States, and only 5% is held by institutions in the U.S. So keep in mind, this doesn't mean, when it says U.S. creditors, that's a broad thing. So it doesn't just mean like the U.S. government or the Federal Reserve. It means like investment banks in the U.S. and so forth. And it's even lower for Portugal. But its indirect exposure is really big. So you can see, like, for Greece, it's 56.3% of the globe's indirect exposure. So what is that distinction referring to, this direct versus indirect? It's referring to things like credit default swaps. So if you're an institution in Germany and you have a bunch of bonds issued by the Greek government, but you have credit default swaps that were issued by an insurance company in the United States, then the way these figures are picking that up is they're going to say, okay, that German institution is going to directly exposed to the Greek government, but it's the U.S. insurance company that's indirectly exposed, because if the Greek government defaults, that German institution, yes, is, oh, I'm taking a hit on my Greek bonds, but I have this credit default swap issued by a U.S. insurance company, so the U.S. insurer is actually the one bearing the brunt of that. All right, so that's what this direct versus indirect exposure means. So you can see for these various at-risk governments that those are pretty big numbers. All right, and then so also you have to backtrack then and say with some of these other figures here that we were going over about the concentration of this debt, some of those numbers aren't as bad as they might seem to the extent that the holders of those bonds hedged away the risk by buying credit default swaps and other things. Okay, so anyway, that's, you can see the issue, and this is why, if for no other reason, the U.S. isn't going to emerge unscathed from this. It's because a lot of the institutions in the U.S. are either directly or more largely indirectly on the hook if any of these sovereign governments defaults. I wanted to also take a few moments to point out that, ironically, I think the Federal Reserve's, what I would call debasement of the dollar, is being temporarily masked by the problems in Europe. So you can see, so what is this? This is a graph of the how many U.S. dollars it takes to get 1 euro. So you can see during the housing bubble years, when they were in their peak phase, the U.S. dollar kept sliding against the euro, that it took more and more U.S. dollars just to buy 1 euro. And it came all the way up through here. And then when the financial crisis hit in the fall of 2008, the dollar strengthened very considerably against the euro, meaning it took fewer dollars to buy 1 euro. And then as things settled back down to normal, the dollar weakened, and then up, there was another, the Eurozone crisis, the dollar strengthened sharply, and then it started weakening again, and then you can see now recently as the crisis has once again been occupying everyone's mind, the dollar has strengthened again pretty sharply. So what's going on there? Well, just obviously, here, this was basically, I think most people would agree, just everybody around the world wanted to hold U.S. treasuries because that was when the whole world was panicking. We thought the whole financial sector was going to collapse. And so people were rushing into treasuries, so that's going to make the dollar appreciate against other currencies, including the euro. But now, specifically in these things, people are going into treasuries, but it's also just they're getting out of the euro. So what's my point is that, I think Bernanke, Greenspan, engaged in very reckless monetary policy, and you can see the general fall of the dollar against the euro, not to mention if you looked at the dollar against gold or something like that, it would also be a steady decline in the dollar's purchasing power measured in terms of ounces of gold. But yet, like I say, that gets masked in this region just because the situation in Europe is deteriorating. So my point is, don't be surprised if the dollar rallies over the next year, depending on how this euro situation plays out. And don't be surprised if the yield on U.S. treasuries still stays remarkably low, even though you keep thinking in terms of Austrian economics, what the heck? The policies that the federal government and the Federal Reserve are implementing are awful. Aren't they worried about price inflation in the U.S.? Why is the dollar apparently staying so strong, and I'm saying, well, it's partly because if the Eurozone is collapsing and investors flee into the dollar, that that would make it appear strong. And really, the way, part of the way that I would disentangle that is to look at gold and silver. And you could say those are, in a sense, the truly safe currencies, you know, the market's money, commodity money. And so just because the dollar, one fiat currency, is strengthening against the euro, a different fiat currency, don't think that the dollar in some absolute sense is really strong, because the dollar and the euro would be falling against gold and silver. And so that's, you know, that's the way you could try to disentangle those things and say, is it really that the dollar is so great, or is it just that the euro is so awful? So I think the big question here, what we want to figure out is the, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't finish the train of thought before, you know, talking about Europe. I don't have any answers for you. And I'm reading the news like you guys are. I don't have some special insight into European politics. I wouldn't even pretend that to get to bluff and say something to you guys. You know, I can talk much more comfortably about what I think is going to happen in the U.S. I really don't know the culture of all the various European players enough and know the politics and how they work to be able to even offer a guess. I'm just trying to equip you with the various facts and let you understand what the issues are. So the issues are, if Germany does just throw Greece to the wolves, as it looked like they may have been ready to do a couple days ago. I gave you that one news article, and now people are kind of backing off of that. Then it's entirely possible that the euro would collapse. So there's various outcomes. One thing is the ECB just says, no, we are bailing out everybody. We are going to print as much as we need to. We will buy up 100% of all of the debt of all these governments if we need to. And every time they need more debt, you know, they can issue it to the private sector for 10 minutes and we'll come in and buy it from them going forward. Case closed. Well, then, yeah, in that case, the governments wouldn't need to default, because the ECB could just say, we stand prepared to do that and we'll keep your interest rates down at 5%. And they could do whatever they want if they're literally the only ones buying it, if they're making the market. So they could do that if they wanted to. And so what would happen if investors believed that that was going to work? The crisis would subside, so people in the private sector would be willing to trade sovereign bonds at whatever interest rate the ECB had decided it was going to target. And I just made up the 5%. Because they would think, I'll just give it to the ECB. So what would happen, you know, if you try to say, well, but the ECB is not omnipotent, how could that fail? So that if it worked, they could get through this crisis and then it would be okay, unless some new issue popped up, which if you believe in Austrian business cycle theory, you think it would, because just printing money doesn't solve things. But that's one way they could get through this. How could that blow up in their face is if the underlying fundamentals kept deteriorating such that the ECB really did have to just create hundreds and hundreds of billions of new euros every few months in order to keep yields from rising and to keep bailing out these governments, eventually you'd start seeing prices rise, quoted in euros, and an inflationary boom would start. And so they, at some point they would have to decide, are we going to back off of this and stop printing, or are we just going to keep doing it, at which point eventually investors would abandon the euro and they would just dump it. And they, you know, so it would ultimately be a currency collapse. So that's the issue when we say, you know, in principle, what would stop the ECB from just running the printing press no matter what to get the objective they wanted? Well, the ultimate thing would be people could just abandon the currency. So I'm not predicting that would happen. I'm just explaining the ultimate constraints on their actions. You know, they have to be careful about the pledges they make. they don't want to box themselves into a corner where they've committed to printing so many euros that ultimately that would lead to runaway price inflation. Another option would be if they allowed for everybody to stay in the eurozone, but they did an orderly default process and debt restructuring and hope that that satisfied investors and the people thought, okay, that's fine, we learned our lesson, and then going forward, we're just going to be more careful. So who knows if that would work. Or they could just maybe kick out Greece and but then keep everybody else in and bail everybody else out and say, yeah, Greece was too weak, they couldn't be saved, so we're concentrating our resources on other people, and, you know, maybe Greece isn't on the euro anymore, but everyone else still is. You know, they might try that route. Or it could just completely unravel, and they could just say, forget this, this was a bad experiment, nobody's using the euro anymore, we're all going back to our individual currencies. So, like I said, I don't even want to stick my neck out and pick one of those scenarios. I guess, well, I'm pretty sure ECB is not going to say we will print an infinite amount of euros if we need to. I don't think they're going to do the analog of what the Swiss National Bank did, because I think central bankers don't like to talk like that. They want to make it look like they're very disciplined and they have, you know, very specific goals in mind, and that the idea of just printing and printing and printing to solve the problem, they don't want to give that impression, even if that's what they're actually doing. Okay, so but now back to the United States. For me, the what could really make this turn from a continental crisis, namely something affecting primarily Europe, into a global catastrophe, is if the European Central Bank gets into trouble, if the euro starts faltering, you know, so going back here, if this, let's say this line just kept going down, you know, what if we achieved parity, and then what if it kept sinking, and what if you could buy a euro with only 75 cents? I mean, the United States would not let that happen, because that would kill our exports. Just like the Swiss National Bank didn't want the Swiss franc to keep appreciating so much against the euro, will it be the same thing with the dollar? If the dollar kept strengthening, you know, this line kept dropping, eventually, you know, I can just imagine the cacophony of people demanding that Bernanke inflate. So that would be how I think the U.S. would then get sucked into this, and then it would just truly be a global financial crisis at that point. Just like we saw the progression, in the beginning, it was just, well, let me move on to the next slide. Okay, so here's my bird's eye big picture thoughts on how this thing has developed and why at every step the policymakers made the wrong decisions from an Austrian and libertarian viewpoint, and why this could ultimately endanger literally the whole global financial system. Okay, so in the beginning, what'd you have? You had the tech bubble, you know, the NASDAQ tech stocks, and that crashed in the early 2000s. So Alan Greenspan was the Fed chair at the time. What did he do? He ramped up dollar creation, brought down interest rates to fairly low levels, and held them there. That spawned, I would argue, of course, and we went over this in the first week, that spawned the housing boom. So then a bunch of primarily private sector institutions got in on the action, buying up mortgages. You know, well, first of all, the commercial banks giving mortgages to people they shouldn't have been giving the mortgages to, that pushed up home prices. More and more financial institutions wanted to get exposure to this booming real estate sector. So how'd they do it? Well, all these fancy Wall Street banks bought up thousands of mortgages, sliced them and diced them, made mortgage-backed securities, sold them off to people. So then when the housing bubble burst, all these major banks were in trouble, but this was a private sector thing. So yeah, there were some household names that were going down. But it wasn't like governments were in trouble. It was just things like, oh my gosh, Lehman's in trouble and so forth, and you know, these major investment banks. And it would have, if so this was like by the fall of 2008, if they hadn't done anything, if the various policymakers had just sat back, it would have been awful, but I think it would have been over in 6 months. There would have been lots of bankruptcies, lots of people who thought they were rich, Wall Street tycoons would have ended up being waiters and waitresses perhaps, but the point is, it's not like the Irish government would have fallen. So, but what happened? They didn't want that. That was considered unacceptable to let all these major financial institutions go under. So the various governments around the world bailed all those private bankers out. And then that didn't solve the problem. Because remember, a lot of it was that people were saying this is mostly psychological. But yeah, there's some real issues. There are bad loans that were made and so forth. But they were saying this is mostly a panic that's getting out of control. It's like a bank run. And so people were saying, you know, if we do TARP in the United States, if the Irish government just guarantees all these private bankers' obligations, if the various European governments just, you know, bail out their bankers and so forth, then we'll get through this crisis. That's largely a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's leading to massive assets, fire sales of assets, and just keeps spreading. We need to lock this thing down and just get through this. Okay, well, that they were wrong. There were serious systemic problems, and the governments that guaranteed everything realized they shouldn't have done that. All right, in the United States, it hasn't been nearly as bad as it was in other places, like in Ireland. Okay, so now the problem has spread and grown. Now it's not just an issue of, oh my gosh, if we don't take serious measures, major household financial institutions are going to go down. Now it's, oh my gosh, major governments are going to be insolvent if we don't do something. So that's when the European Central Bank and the IMF and those sorts of other regional governments that weren't in trouble all stepped in, soaked up a bunch of the sovereign debt, and then the crisis spread to them because it didn't solve the problem. Because remember, that was the thing. That was the promise that was made at the time. They said this is largely psychological. Yet, perhaps the Irish government shouldn't have done this, but now that investors are starting to panic and yields are going up, they can't possibly pay this stuff off. So if the ECB can come in and promise to buy up all of this troubled sovereign debt, that will reassure investors they'll be willing to roll the debt over at reasonable interest rates, and then these governments, if they commit to harsh austerity packages, can climb out of this problem and, hey, lesson learned, we're not going to do that again, and we'll get through this. But if the ECB doesn't step in, it's going to be a catastrophe. You're going to have all these governments just, you know, go bankrupt. Okay? But then, again, that advice was bad advice. It didn't work. Now, investors are still alarmed. Yields now are still going through the roof, even after all these bailouts by the European Central Bank, such that the euro itself now is in trouble. So what I'm saying is it's possible if things play out in a certain way and it really does look like, you know, going back to that earlier slide, what if it's possible that the consolidated European Central Bank, meaning all the different national banks under one heading, what if collectively they're going to be rendered insolvent if Greece defaults and Italy defaults and so forth? Then I could see people saying, and that the euro itself, you know, might crash, and that it falls to, you know, 50 U.S. cents to buy 1 euro or something like that. What if that looks like what's going to happen? You could totally imagine in that crisis environment Ben Bernanke saying, okay, don't worry, everybody, I'm going to save the world. That we promise the euro is not going to fall below parity with the dollar, and we stand prepared to buy as much sovereign European debt as we need to keep those yields back down to where they need to be. And of course, we're going to insist on, you know, we're in consultations. Treasury Secretary Geithner is over there meeting with Greek officials and Italian officials and Spanish officials. You know, we're going to make sure that they implement harsh austerity measures to, you know, we're not bailing these people out, but, you know, this is a global catastrophe. We can't let the euro fail on our watch. You could totally see Bernanke saying something like that. Okay, so then at that point, you know, once it's the Federal Reserve and the U.S. dollar now that are the last backstop, the question is, what if that doesn't work? So just to be clear, this last step hasn't happened yet. All these other steps have already happened that I've talked about. But I'm saying if it looks like the ECB wasn't enough and that didn't contain it, and thus far it hasn't, it's getting out of control, slipping away from them, it's possible that they turn to the Fed to say, okay, you are the only entity left on planet Earth that has the power and the prestige to stem this crisis. You can, you know, if investors around the world hear that you're ready to print an unlimited number of dollars, they'll leave us alone. It's very analogous to a bank run, especially in the Rothbardian view, where under fractional reserve banking, the banks are insolvent by definition, or they're illiquid by definition. So, I mean, the moment confidence is lost, it doesn't matter what policies they put into place, they're done. Because by definition, if you're a fractional reserve banker, you can't pay everybody off if they show up and want their money at the same time. So that's why psychology is so important, and that's why they want to have FDIC and whatever the analogs are in Europe in terms of deposit insurance, because you got to convince the public not to try to pull their money out. And so it's the same kind of thing here, where it's largely psychology, but they're trying to use psychology to fix an underlying structural fundamental problem. So the point is, what if the Fed goes on the online and does that, and now the Fed starts picking up hundreds of billions of dollars worth of euro-denominated assets to keep the euro from sinking against the dollar and to keep yields on various European governments' debt from going too high. That probably would solve things for a while, but then what happens if it kicks in again? And then at that point, people realize, uh-oh, now the Fed is going to be rendered insolvent. And then people would have nowhere left to go. I mean, they might try to go to the Canadian dollar or something like that, but you can see if it looks like now the dollar itself is going to crash, what would happen? Well, we're not sure. It's possible people would just rush into gold. I mean, not possible. Of course people would rush into gold and silver. The prices of those things quoted in dollars and euros would go through the roof. But what would happen? So there, you know, who knows? I'd want to see how things develop a little bit more to get more accurate, but it's conceivable, to just throw it out there as the last thing, I'll turn to your questions. Just so you know, there have been lots of feelers put out and people are setting up the ground or the infrastructure for a global reserve currency issued, for example, by the IMF. And so one proposal has said the IMF could issue these things called SDRs, special drawing rights, where the IMF holds a bunch of assets, like dollar-denominated assets, euro-denominated assets, yen-denominated assets, and so forth, as well as stuff like gold. And then they issue these securities, or whatever you want to call them, that give you a claim on those, that pool of assets that the IMF is holding. And so then those SDRs would become the new global reserve currency. And so especially if they had gold in the mix, you could see how people might flock to that thing, and they might be reassured and say, okay, now, you know, it's not just various regional people that are in charge. This is truly a global institution. Now, this is the IMF. This isn't just the ECB or the Federal Reserve. This is the IMF. Okay. You could see things going that way. So And then, again, I'm not predicting that's going to happen, but it's conceivable that's the way things are going. And it's true, if you said that, if in 2001 somebody had said, hey, I bet 13 years from now most Western nations are going to be using one currency, a one world currency, you'd say, what are you, out of your mind? But by the same token, back here, you would not have predicted that Lehman Brothers was going to fail and that the U.S. government was going to nationalize most of the banks and that it was going to own car companies and that the U.S. government was going to be responsible in one way or the other for more than 95% of all the mortgages issued in 2010, which is the case because of Fannie and Freddie. Right, so lots of stuff would have been, or that the U.S. government would be downgraded. That would have been inconceivable just a decade ago. Okay, so, or that, you know, maybe not at that point because it was so new, but just a few years into it, if people said the euro was going to be seriously on the brink of collapse in 5 years, people would have thought that was crazy. Okay, so, like I said, I'm not saying for sure that's what's going to happen, but that is definitely the trend. So the crucial thing, like I say, is we're not yet at this point right here in the chain. So it'll be curious to see. Perhaps this euro crisis will subside and we won't hear about it again. I don't think so, but, you know, could happen. But if it does flare up again and it looks like the various institutions in Europe can't handle it, instead of letting it collapse, I could see them turn into the Fed, and then that would be the question, is the Fed going to do it? And that's why I'm so frustrated with the elite opinion makers in the United States who keep berating Bernanke for his allegedly tight monetary policies. It's because I think they are giving him the excuse that if they did want to go this way, he could go ahead and do it. And then if it blew up in his face and then we had to get a global currency, they could just say, well, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time, just like all these things seemed like good ideas at the time that mainstream economists thought, oh, this is what you need. Don't listen to those idiot Austrians and libertarians. They're morons. Well, if they had listened to the Austrians and libertarians, this is where we would have been. That there would have been a bad recession in 2002 because of the collapse of the tech bubble, and then that would have been it. But now we're at this stage because they kept intervening and doing Keynesian solutions every step of the way. Okay, let me see if you guys got any questions for me. So while I'm logging in here, this is the last lecture of the course, so thanks to everybody for registering. I hope you learned some things, and if you want to give us feedback, we'd be curious, because this is obviously a different type of course. Normally I do things like go through established Austrian theory and try to teach it, whereas this was largely just current events and giving you a bunch of information so you were more informed, and it was just sort of light on Austrian theory. So let us know if you kind of like this new mix or if you like the other kind of stuff better, so we'll know in terms of offering you classes in the future what you want to see. Okay, where the heck are we here? So if you are taking the class for credit, this is the last week, so there is going to be a normal multiple choice quiz on the readings for this week and the lecture I just gave that will be available this Friday for that full week. And then after that, there will be a final exam covering all 4 weeks. So I will, of course, send out emails so you know what's going on, but just be aware that that's coming. Okay, questions for the professor, week 4. Okay, Martin says, the recent trends article reports a drop in percentage in treasury debt from 2000 to 2010, but I suspect the absolute numbers would show an increase in the Fed's holding. Is this true? Yeah, it's true. It's an enormous increase. in terms of how much treasury debt does the Fed hold. It's way higher in 2010 than it was in the year 2000 in terms of the absolute dollar figures. Off the top of my head, I don't know what they are, but I'll post those. Okay, and Martin, it looks like you're asking for the correct answers to the quizzes. I thought after the quiz that you could check that. So if not, Martin, let me know. But it was my understanding that once the quiz is closed, you can go and look, and it'll show you what the right answer was. Okay, Alan Burton says, would it be safe to say that a theme running through this course is that smaller bubbles have been bailed out by the banking bailouts and now heading toward the ultimate sovereign currency crashes, as Mises predicted? Well, yeah, Alan, obviously, that's how I just wrapped up the lecture. That's exactly what I'm saying, and I do think it's consistent with Mises' thesis about how there's no middle ground, that either you go towards, you embrace free market capitalism, or you go towards outright central planning. That middle of the road policy is inconsistent. So, you know, Mises talks about price controls. That okay, the government wants to help poor mothers give milk to their kids, so they put price controls on milk. So they want to make milk cheaper than the market price would be. But that obviously, if that's the only intervention they did, that would just lead to shortages of milk, which is the exact opposite of what they wanted. So then the government can either abandon that intervention or it can do more, and it'll go in and say to the farmers, well, how come you're not selling milk now at the grocery store? And they'll say, well, because you guys, you know, you're not unless charge enough for it. And so they'll say, oh, okay, well, what if we make it cheaper for you to raise cattle? And so we'll put price controls on the stuff that you need to produce milk. And they say, oh, okay. And then, of course, it just keeps spreading. So it's an analogous thing here, like I said in that last slide, where they just kept making things worse and worse and worse, staving off the inevitable and making the problems fester. And I am concerned that they haven't learned their lesson yet. And this, again, especially coupled with all of this, because the problem, in case you guys don't know what I'm talking about, there are a lot of bloggers who are, you know, academic economists who have their models, and the quasi-monetarists are the ones I have in mind. So it's not just the Keynesians like Paul Krugman. It's also guys who in other respects are pretty free market, guys who were trained at the University of Chicago, even guys who were trained by like George Selgin. All right, so that's the really interesting twist to this. So David Beckworth, if you know his name, he calls himself a quasi-monetarist. And he knows the Austrian school. I'm not saying he's an expert in Austrian economics, but he was taught, I don't remember the exact guy, but he was taught by somebody like Larry White or George Selgin. I mean, one of those kind of guys is, you know, in David Beckworth's educational background. And so that's why I get so frustrated with these guys, is that their saying the reason we're in this problem is that nominal GDP is growing too slowly, and that Bernanke has been engaging in a tight monetary policy since 2008. So to me, I can't believe we're even having this discussion, but they believe that, and that's what they've been advocating for the last 3 years. And what's crazy, or what's alarming, is they're convincing more and more people, like Tyler Cowen and David Henderson, and you know some other guys that, I mean, Tyler Cowen's not, you know, a staunch free marketeer, but David Henderson is, a guy at EconLog, and I think even Brian Kaplan. So a lot of these people who didn't really have strong views on monetary policy one way or the other have now, in my mind, been seduced by these quasi-monetarists. They're saying, oh, yeah, Bernanke really ought to inflate more. Let's see if that works. So and that's the thing, too, that's so frustrating, is it's not like they're even saying we're sure this is going to work. They're just saying, well, it might work. We should give it a shot because nothing else is working. I mean, that's where the debate has gone in terms of PhD economists who spend a lot of time talking about public policy. That's actually now the state of the debate is they've sort of joined forces with Krugman to say, it might not work because people don't believe the Fed's really going to debase the dollar, but they might as well try to get the public to think that and see if it helps. So my point is, if there's this calamity developing in Europe where it looks like if the Fed doesn't step in, all of Europe is going to be plunged back into the dark ages, the fact that now you've got all these people nudging the Fed, come on, inflate more, inflate more, inflate more, all it can do is help. It can't possibly hurt. The Bernanke will have the green light if he wants it, at least as far as academic circles are concerned. And it would just be, the ignorant natives with their pitchforks and Rick Perry, you know, with his southern twang talking about Bernanke being a traitor. That would be the only thing at that point standing in their way. So it's I think that the academic Austrians, like, we've lost. You know, I hate to be so pessimistic on this, but I mean, it's, if we can't even get free market guys to realize that running the printing press is not the way to get out of recession, then what the heck are we doing? So anyway, sorry to complain to you guys like this. I'm demoralized right now. Okay, Senthil says, oh, wait a minute. Maybe you're, well, it looks like you're, sorry, I'm having trouble with your question. You say, is it to influence the price of gold? India's central bank bought 200 tons of gold when the IMF dumped gold. China and Russia have said they will buy whatever the IMF dumps. What is the reasoning for the IMF to sell gold? I don't know off the top. I mean, I'd want to do more research on this particular episode that you're referring to. It's been well documented that central banks manipulate the price of gold, right? So that's not a conspiracy theory. Alan Greenspan and other officials have said things in testimony that, you know, they were saying it matter-of-factly. That, oh, yeah, if the price of gold is outside of a certain range that we think is conducive to economic growth, then we'll take measures to but what they're saying is we're controlling the price of gold. That if we think the price of gold is too high, we will come in and try to knock it down. So, and for the reason I said before, the beauty, if you're an interventionist, of fiat money, central banking, is that you can do whatever you want. There's no constraints, whereas the gold standard put a constraint on you. But now that there is this private market for gold, and, you know, and if you have all these coordinated expansions, it's not even going to show up as your currency falling against another currency. You know, the Fed and the ECB can inflate in unison, and the dollar won't fall against the euro or vice versa. But the pesky price of gold is there. And, you know, gold has just been rising for the last 10 years. And so that's always a slap in the face. So that's the one thing people can point to who aren't even ideological and say, wait a minute, why is gold above 1800 now if we have a tight money policy? What the heck does that mean? So so I think you're right that yes, they're trying to they want to suppress the price of gold. But now at this point, and that was partly why I gave you that article, in terms of it's hard to predict where this is going to go, is a lot of governments and central banks lately have started accumulating gold because I think they realize, you know, the dollar's days may be numbered, that they don't like the way this is going, and they want to back themselves up and be holding a real asset if and when the storm comes. Okay, Gary asks, why should a central bank worry about capital losses and insolvency? Does it have any demand liabilities it could not meet by printing more money with additional asset purchases? Okay, so I largely talked about this in the lecture, but just to fill in the blanks there. So it's true if a given central bank, if its liabilities consist of or are denominated in foreign currencies, well, then the fact that it can print money doesn't help it. Right? So if the European Central Bank owes, it has dollar liabilities to somebody, then the fact that it can print euros out of thin air, that doesn't help. And remember, that's what happened in Iceland, that those banks had foreign-denominated debts, and so that's why they were initially in so much trouble, that even devaluing in terms of their own currency wasn't going to help them. So, but like with the Federal Reserve, most of its liabilities are in dollars, so the Fed doesn't care. Like I said, though, Gary, I think it's beyond just the mechanics of it. It's also a matter of, because if you think of, I was going to say what you could do is create a bunch of euros. Like, let's say the ECB owes dollars. They could print up a bunch of euros and buy some other asset from somebody and then sell it for dollars. And there, you know, as long as they could get ahead of the curve and not make the euro-dollar exchange rate fall too much, you know, maybe that's the way they could do it. But in general, I don't think that's really the big issue, especially when you're talking about the Fed or the ECB. I think the issue is it would be very awkward if it were insolvent, because everybody would know, okay, you guys don't play by the rules. So, I mean, that's why they had liabilities in the first place. When a fiat currency, how is that a liability? That's not. Like, that's just a throwback to the days of the gold standard when the Treasury gave you a $20 note that was a liability to the U.S. Treasury that meant we've got $20 worth of gold sitting here that you can redeem. And then when they abandon the gold link, they still refer to those things as notes, even though they're not liabilities anymore. So I think that's just partly in their ruse fooling the public and making it look like a central bank is like a regular bank, when in fact, no, there's something qualitatively different. Last question, Gary says, how does growth in the central bank's balance sheet cause price inflation when there is low capacity utilization and high unemployment? What is the specific process of transmission? Historical examples in the U.S., might be the U.S. in the 70s, or Germany and Austria after World War I when they had hyperinflation. So, good question. I think it's because, let me just give you sort of a generic answer. You have to ask, why is there unemployment? And so there, I think from an Austrian viewpoint, it's going to be that the labor was in the wrong area and it needs to get reallocated. And so either workers just have to keep searching until they find the right spot who can pay them what they want, or they have to lower their wage demands. And so if the government prints, or if the Fed prints up a bunch of money and then all the prices rise, well, if the worker before could only find a job working for $20 an hour and he insisted on making $25, and so that's why he was unemployed, because he was holding out saying, no, I'm not taking a job for $20 an hour. I need a job that pays me $25 an hour. And now the Fed doubles the money supply and all prices double. And of course, as Austrians, we know that wouldn't happen. It would be sequential and there'd be different effects. But just for simplicity, say all the prices double, then yeah, that person, that same employer would now be willing to offer that person $40 an hour. And so you might think that that should cure the unemployment problem. But if the worker's smart, if before he was insisting on 25, now he's going to insist on 50. So printing money and raising prices, the only reason it could possibly help, except by attributing it to irrationality and that people don't understand how prices work and what purchasing power is, but you know, the way you could do it in terms of not assuming that the workers are just fools is you'd have to tell a sort of complicated story about debt contracts and things along those lines, right? And that's kind of what those quasi-monetarists do, and New Keynesians also might bring that aspect into it. So there, what's happening is if all prices double, then the debtors are relatively, you know, gain at the expense of the creditors, and if the numbers work out right, for some reason that helps economic growth, and that allows for them to employ more people. But, I mean, I don't like that kind of story anyway. But absent that, like I said, just printing money, I mean, just theoretically, there's no real reason that that should matter. The only way it does matter is if, for some reason, workers are particularly attached to nominal quantities. And you can tell stories, and some economists do, about why a worker wouldn't take a 5% wage cut, but he would be okay continuing to work for the same salary, even though prices in general go up 5%. Some people think that there's an asymmetry between those two outcomes. And to the extent that you believe that, well, then, yeah, it makes sense. If there's unemployment right now, a modest price inflation might reduce unemployment. But again, like you say, we've seen plenty of cases where that's not the case. And so I think the ultimate answer is, for whatever reason, you had unemployment or idle resources before, after prices rise, you just adjust the numbers, and it's the same situation. Okay, well, let me stop there. So again, thanks everybody for participating in the class, and I will send out emails regarding the quiz and the final exam.